The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. On Capitol Hill, national security has emerged again as a huge political issue as Congress debated reauthorization of the Patriot Act, passed in the anxiety-filled days just after 9/11. Now the Senate has approved a compromise that came from the House called the USA Freedom Act. Meanwhile, this subject has spread to the presidential primary campaign trail, where, by the way, both the Republican and Democratic fields keep getting larger. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham is the latest GOP entrant. He announced on Monday in his hometown of Central.
Some of you have known me since my family lived in the back of the bar in that building. But I'm pretty sure no one here, including me, ever expected to hear me say, I'm Lindsey Graham and I'm running for president of the United States.
This hour on The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin is back. Each month, Ken joins us with his veteran observer's eye on the political news of the nation. Let's hear from you, too. Your questions and comments for Ken are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ken, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, before we dive into the substance of our show, Ken, a trivia question this month for us.
The trivia question is, who was the last presidential candidate who also ran for governor, for mayor, for the United States Senate, and for the U.S. House?
A very busy person, for
yes.
Sure. Okay, so exchange listeners, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us your guess by email, exchange at nhpr.org. No Googling the answer. That goes against the spirit of a trivia challenge. And here's the question again. Who was the last presidential candidate who also ran for governor, mayor, Congress, and senator? Now, Ken, that doesn't necessarily mean he or she won that seat, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So who was the last presidential candidate who also ran for governor, mayor, Congress, and senator? Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Kicking off the monthly check-in with political junkie Ken Rudin with a trivia question, as we often do. So, Ken, let's dive into the politics of national security. And wow, this has been a huge story. Just remind us of what's being debated on Capitol Hill. What's really at stake here?
Well, it started when an appeals court ruled that there's the NSA, the National Security Agency's program of bulk data phone collection was illegal, that they were storing private information of millions of American citizens, and that was unconstitutional, ruled by an appeals court. So basically, they told Congress that, you know, you can't continue to rely on this. So, and basically, the NSA got this allowance from Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which they interpreted as giving them license to do all this bulk collection of data. So Congress realized that something had to be done, and there were some options. You could either get rid of the Patriot Act and start all over again, or, as the House did, pass a revision bill called the USA Freedom Act, which passed overwhelmingly in the House a few weeks ago, that, you know, it basically takes the information out of the NSA and the government and keeps it in the hands of the phone companies. Now, Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader, insisted that the Patriot Act and the programs we're talking about were extremely important, that if we had that prior to 9/11, there wouldn't have been a 9/11. And so Mitch McConnell, a very canny, savvy ruler, and he tries to be a ruler, but he's not, of the Senate, expected to have an extension of the Patriot Act. But because of basically the activity of one man, his fellow Kentucky Republican, Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell was stymied by that. So he tried to get the Senate to do something before last week's Memorial Day break, a recess. He failed because of Rand Paul. And so he had to swallow yesterday the bill that basically what the House passed, the USA Freedom Act.
Well, and Senator Paul will be in New Hampshire this weekend, coming to Concord, I think. But let's hear Senator Rand Paul talking about this issue on the Senate floor.
We are not collecting the information of spies. We are not collecting the information of terrorists. We are collecting all American citizens' records all of the time. This is what we fought the revolution over. Are we going to so blithely give up our freedom? Are we going to so blithely go along and just say, take it?
Again, that's Kentucky Senator Rand Paul talking about debate over the renewal of the Patriot Act, how it should be changed. So, Ken Rudin, how does this work as a political issue for Rand Paul? You know, he's running for president, so he's got to pay attention to both his Senate career, but also his presidential prospects.
Well, that's a good question, because basically this is the kind of policies that, one, his father, Ron Paul, utilized in his two bids for the presidency. And two, Rand Paul basically said that this is that government interference, government overreach, whether it becomes a government surveillance or drone attacks on people around the world, is just not what this government should be involved in. Now, that is true to libertarian principles, to libertarians around the country. But at the same time, is that the kind of vote, is that the kind of position that works well in a Republican primary? Lindsey Graham and other Republicans say no, that you got to stand up, you got to be tough against international terrorism, that, you know, there's been perhaps, as Mitch McConnell argues, that these sections of the Patriot Act is really what's been keeping America safe in the past 10 years or so. So anyway, that's the big battle within the Republican Party. Rand Paul was trying to make, you know, get a little cozy with the establishment Republicans. He was boning more and more in some foreign aid. He was talking about the threat of ISIS, which he had downplayed initially. So ultimately, it looks like that Rand Paul is coming down the side of his libertarian beliefs and away from the Republican regulars, who now detest him, for one, embarrassing Mitch McConnell, and two, just stymieing McConnell's leadership of the Senate.
Well, and I have heard some top Republicans say, you know, that Americans are concerned about homegrown terror cells, about the expanding might of ISIS overseas. Here's CIA Director John Brennan speaking on CBS's Face the Nation about this whole Patriot Act renewal debate.
She shouldn't be president of the United States because she's
okay, and that's not the right cut. Obviously, that's not John
Brennan. That was him with a high voice.
We'll try to get back to that in just a moment. I also want to remind our listeners it's Political Junkie Hour with Ken Rudin. You can join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR.
So Laura, can I just say something on that?
Sure.
Just quickly. But there's also the fact is that, I mean, if you look at what the American public opinion was like and the way Congress was shortly after 9/11, there was no question that let's pass this Patriot Act. But the revelations a few years ago by Edward Snowden, the revelation that the government basically has been spying on so many millions of Americans, has really turned around a lot of opinion. So the fact is, you know, Russ Feingold, the former senator from Wisconsin, was the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act in 2001. And now we had 77 senators, 67 senators yesterday, who voted to really to revamp those bills. So there is public opinion turning around.
Sure. So now we've got that sound of CIA Director John Brennan speaking on CBS about this.
These tools are all part of a package of safeguards that has been put in place. And so the president, the attorney general, the director of FBI, director of national intelligence, the heads of NSA and CIA, all are very supportive of an extension of those capabilities and those authorities. And unfortunately, I think that there's been a little bit too much political grandstanding and crusading for ideological causes that has really skewed the debate on this issue. But these tools are important to American lives.
Okay. And again, that's CIA Director John Brennan speaking on CBS. And Ken, we've been talking about how this has divided Republicans. What about Democrats? Has this been an issue for them or not so much?
It has. I mean, they're very happy to sit back and watch the Republicans beat up each other. For the most part, Democrats seem to be very willing and eager in some ways to alter and to revise the tenets of the Patriot Act. Some say that we should start from the beginning. Some say the revisions passed by the House and yesterday by the Senate are fine. But for the most part, Democrats are sitting back enjoying the show.
Well, again, the number for you to join us on the Political Junkie Hour with Ken Rudin is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And once again, exchange listeners, here's Ken's trivia question for us this month. Who was the last presidential candidate who also ran for governor, mayor, Congress, and senator? Ken, we've got some folks who think they know the answer. Mike's calling from Bennington. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Is it Richard Nixon?
Was it Richard Nixon? Thanks, Mike.
Well, Richard Nixon was a member of the House when he was elected for the Senate. And, of course, in 1962, he also ran for governor against Pat Brown and lost in California. But he never ran for mayor.
Okay, so a couple offices. Again, governor, mayor, Congress, and senator. Good guess, Mike. And here's an email from Christopher in Manchester who asks, was it Jerry Brown?
Well, Jerry Brown is another good guess because he was mayor of Oakland.
Right.
He did run for the Senate in 1982 against Pete Wilson. And, of course, he was and is governor of California, but never ran for the House.
Wow, this is a tough one.
These are great guesses.
They are great guesses. All right, well, thank you, Christopher, for that one. Again, if you think you know the answer, 1-800-892-6477. Can I give them a clue, Ken? Because this seems to be a
tough one. Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. No. No, we don't have these expensive gifts to give away and give them clues as well.
Okay. Again, if you think you know the answer, who was the last presidential candidate who also ran for governor, mayor, Congress, and senator? So last thing for you, Ken.
By the way, Laura, when I told you this question, did you say that our audience is going to get it immediately?
I did. I thought people would get this really easily.
Okay, I thought they would. Well, that's a clue right there.
Yeah. So real quickly, just to wrap up this this NSA issue, now that this has gone through the Senate, President Obama has it, does this die down as an issue, or does it continue to be sort of discussed?
Well, I think, of course, the intensity and the deadline drama, which we always see in the Senate, that's gone away. But the enmity between McConnell and Paul will not go away. And it's interesting because Mitch McConnell has endorsed his fellow Kentucky Republican, Rand Paul, for the presidency. But there are a lot of Republicans. We saw John McCain. We saw McConnell. We saw Lindsey Graham for a long time, really upset and angry with Rand Paul. And I'd love to see how long that goes on in Paul's presidential campaign.
All right. Well, coming up, Ken, I've got some more folks who think they know the answer to our trivia question, so we'll go to them. I also want to ask you about how the Iraq war debate and the whole question of whether or not America should have gone in there has returned, made for some very tricky politics, especially for Jeb Bush. We'll find out more. This is the Political Junkie Hour on the Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Political junkie Ken Rudin is here. Once a month, we check in with Ken on some of the nation's top political stories. And in a moment, Ken, I do want to talk about how presidential candidates have been rehashing the whole rationale for going into Iraq. But first, let's get a correct answer to our trivia question for the month, which is, again, who was the last presidential candidate who also ran for governor, mayor, Congress, and senator? And Andy has emailed us. Ken, Andy says, my guess is Hubert Humphrey.
Well, Hubert, what a great guess, but it's not Hubert Humphrey, because Hubert Humphrey, of course, was the mayor of Minneapolis when he was elected to the Senate in 1948, but never ran for governor and never ran for the House.
Okay, so let's take a call. Mary in Charlestown. Do you know Mary? Go ahead. You're on the air.
Dennis Kucinich.
Oh, he was mayor of Cleveland. That's true. Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
He was mayor of Cleveland, then he was elected to the House, but he never ran for governor and he never ran for the Senate.
Okay, so ran for president and was mayor and was in Congress, but not Senate. So he got to hit all four categories. Right. Okay. Thank you for trying, Mary. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Ken, you seem to have stumped people this month. Here's Bruce Alsop.
Nobody's guessing Margaret Chase Smith.
Yeah, that was our answer last month and the month before. Here's Bruce Al Smith of New York.
Wow. Well, I know Al Smith was sheriff of New York and he was governor, but I know he never ran for the Senate and he never ran for the House.
Okay. So thank you, Bruce, for that one. Good guess, but not quite on it. We will continue to take your guesses by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And again, no looking it up on Google or another search engine. It's not in the spirit of the thing. Ken, let's return to presidential politics and the idea that the whole rationale for going into Iraq is being rehashed. We're returning to this question, should we or should we not have engaged militarily in Iraq? How do you hear this bubbling up again, and who's talking about it the most?
Well, what's remarkable about this question is that certainly, as we saw, that it's basically is one of the issues that stymied Hillary Clinton in 2008 when she first ran for president. Of course, she said that, yes, I did vote to go to war against Saddam Hussein, but because I was misled by the Bush administration. Now, anybody who admits being misled by the Bush administration is not making a good case for her candidacy. And Barack Obama really used that issue to say, look, I'm pure on the war. I was against it from the beginning, even though he was only in the Illinois state legislature. He was against it from the beginning, and that was the end of Hillary Clinton in 2008 because of the war. But anyway, if your name is Jeb Bush, and you have if you coincidentally have a brother named George W. Bush, who basically was the architect of the, I'd say, failed war policy in Iraq, how could you not be prepared for questions on whether it was the right thing to do or, you know, all those kind of questions? But it seems like on five different occasions, Jeb Bush, who still has not officially announced his candidacy, even though he's raising a gazillion dollars a week, he still gave five different answers on what the right answer was. Was your brother correct? Was it the right policy? Things like if you knew then what you knew now, blah, blah, blah. But he just seemed to be so unready for that question, it surprised a lot of people.
Well, here's what Jeb Bush said in New Hampshire. Here he is speaking at an event in Portsmouth recently, which aired on MSNBC.
The focus ought to be on knowing what you know now, Mr. President. Should you have kept 10,000 troops in Iraq, or 15,000, or 4,000? That's the better answer, because of yesterday, Ramadi has now been taken over by ISIS. ISIS didn't exist when my brother was president. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was wiped out when my brother was president.
So there's Jeb Bush speaking in Portsmouth again on MSNBC and kind of trying to turn it around there, Ken, saying, you know, my brother made things better in Iraq and it's gotten worse under President Obama. That's the tactic.
That's a tough case to make. I mean, given the fact that if you think of what Iraq was like before, nobody's saying that Saddam Hussein was a good guy and he didn't commit atrocities, and he did. Did he use poison gas against his own people? Yes, he did. But if nothing else, he, like Tito in Yugoslavia, kept warring religious factions apart because he's such a strong man. I'm not endorsing Saddam Hussein, but the absence, the toppling of Hussein with no infrastructure left to control the country led to these warring factions. I'm not, you know, there were some people, including Rand Paul, believe it or not, who said that George W. Bush is responsible for the growth and the creation of the Islamic State because the Ba'athists were thrown out of power when the Shiites took over in Iraq. Whoever's responsible for it, I would say that that Iraq was much more of a calming presence. Again, that's a tough word to use, than it is now when it seems to be engulfing the entire Mideast.
Okay. Well, I think we have someone who knows the answer to your trivia question.
Wait a second. You're giving it away in advance. You're not supposed to know. You're supposed to be surprised, like America is.
Let's take Terry in Hollis. Hi, Terry. What do you think?
Hi, I think it's Bernie Sanders.
Ken?
I have no comment. No, it is Bernie Sanders. It is Bernie Sanders. He was not only the mayor of Burlington, who then was elected to the House and the Senate, but he also ran for governor several times as a candidate of the fringe Liberty Union Party. Back then, Bernie Sanders was getting 1%, 2% of the polls, and he was really seen as a gadfly. And now, his last time he ran for the Senate re-election, he got 71% of the vote. So Bernie Sanders has seen it all.
All right. Well, that's the right answer. And this was a tough one. So congratulations, Terry. I thought people would get it, given that, you know, Senator Sanders is right next door in Vermont. But it was a good one.
Yeah, I just didn't want you to tell people that she had the answer right in advance. I wanted everybody to be surprised and shocked, and I wanted Terry to say, "Oh, Ken, thanks so much. You made my day." But it didn't turn out that way.
Let's take another call on some of the substantive issues that we've been talking about, from the Patriot Act debate to the issue of the Iraq War resurfacing in the presidential race. Trevor's joining us from Bethlehem. Hi, Trevor. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to address something that was brought up earlier, them saying that the bulk phone data collection could have stopped 9/11. I want to point out that people representing the CIA and various other government agencies have been asked multiple times to point out just one example of one attack or one American life being saved by the bulk phone data collection, and they cannot do it. And if that had ever happened, they'd be parading it through the streets so that they could keep doing it, would they not?
So some skepticism on your part, Trevor, that this really would have made a difference. And we hear that from some of our politicians, too, don't we, Ken?
Oh, I think Trevor makes a very good point. Nobody has conclusively come out and said this program stopped X, Y, or Z. It's just like with the wiretaps, and people say, well, you know, we have the waterboarding and the torture that was condoned early in the Bush administration and maybe winked at by the Obama administration. And then when asked, it turns out, though, it may not have brought any kind of results that we wanted. But Trevor is right. If the government if this was helping the government's case, if it was uncovering plots around the world, I would suspect that the government would say, here's an example of it.
So this is the dynamic that we're seeing in the presidential race, at least on the Republican side, Ken, right? Sort of the hawks who are saying we need to keep an eye on all this, and people like Rand Paul and others who are saying, you know, this isn't right. And by the way, it's not kept us safer. That's the divide there.
Well, this is a historical, theological or philosophical debate in our country's history, security versus liberty. Obviously, Rand Paul is on the liberty side, saying that you cannot infringe constitutional rights just to make us safer, because ultimately we become less safe if we have less liberty. So that debate has been going on since Jeffersonian days. And it continues today under Obama-onian days.
So, again, Rand Paul running for president, making that case very strongly. On the other side, Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, jumped into the race on Monday. He's more from the hawkish wing, right, Ken?
Well, I mean, to say the least, he and John McCain are among the let's put the troops on the ground wing of the Republican Party, because obviously Iraq and Afghanistan went so well that I think the feeling is, but no, I'm making fun, but he is a really very hawkish on issues. He always has been on military defense and foreign affairs and things like that. And for years, he's been battling. I mean, he's been in the Senate since 2002. He succeeded Strom Thurmond. He was in the House before that. He's been around a long time. And he's been battling Rand Paul's views on what to do with the Pentagon budget and the Pentagon's aims and goals and things like that. And it's interesting because, you know, I mean, he has all this experience. I mean, whether you support him or not, because not everybody supports more military intervention around the world, but many Republican voters do. Yet he's at the very, you know, since he announced his exploratory committee in January, he's just not made any mark on anything. Nobody's paying attention to him. And, you know, with the first debate coming up on August 6th, that in Cleveland, run by Fox TV, that basically if you're not among the top 10 finishers in an average of 5 polls, you're not going to be included in the debate. And that's what Lindsey Graham and so many other Republicans are worried about.
Well, and he's been spending a fair bit of time here in the Granite State. And it's interesting, Ken, you know, again, Lindsey Graham known as a hawk on foreign policy. But here's Senator Graham talking about his feelings on other issues, stressing his centrist bipartisan record during his announcement speech on Monday in Central South Carolina.
To Americans who trust neither party, I will seek the political common ground our nation so desperately needs to find. That's what I've done before. Don't take my word for it. Examine my record. I got the scars to prove it.
So there's Senator Graham admitting that it's not always easy to have that seek that political common ground. How's that going to play in New Hampshire, Ken?
Well, two very important points here. First of all, what Lindsey Graham said is absolutely true. For many people, Lindsey Graham is seen as a regular conservative, a very conservative kind of guy. But if you go back to South Carolina, you'll find that at least three times in the past, he's been censured by local county Republican committees because he's too liberal, that he cooperates too much with the Obama administration, that he had the temerity to vote for some Obama Supreme Court justices, and that was just not the way conservatives should be. So, and plus the fact he has views on immigration that turns off some hardliners. So Lindsey Graham has been a bit of an independent maverick, like his good friend John McCain. And of course, when you're talking about New Hampshire, you are thinking about independent voters and independent ways of thought, and the fact that, again, John McCain won New Hampshire twice in 2000 and 2008. It rescued, or at least briefly rescued, his candidacy both times. And, of course, Lindsey Graham would love that kind of boost that John McCain got twice.
Again, our number here in the Exchange, it's the Political Junkie Hour with Ken Rudin. Once a month, we check in with Ken on some of the nation's top political stories. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, especially with the many, many, many presidential candidates roaming around New Hampshire. If you've bumped into one or two or three, we'd love your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Ken, I want to ask you about Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side. But first, you piqued my interest there. You talked about the August 6th Republican debate in Cleveland, not that far away.
No.
We're going to do a whole show on Monday about this debate, you know, who's up on that big stage and who isn't. But I'd love your thoughts about that now. How are debate organizers going to decide who gets to attend and who doesn't?
Well, it's basically in the handled by the networks that are sponsoring the debates. And as I said, the first one is by Fox News. And Fox News, I mean, the question is an obvious logistical question. How do you fit 16 or 19 or how many Republican candidates there will be on one stage? It's obviously not easy. So what Fox News has decided, and the Republican National Committee has backed it, is that they will take an average of five national polls, and the top 10 finishers of the 16 or 17 or 18 Republican candidates will be on the debate. So that means that, you know, you may get a Donald Trump, for example, who's not declared yet, but he is said to be the heir apparent. But anyway, but Donald Trump may be on it because of his notoriety, and yet somebody like Lindsey Graham or George Pataki, the former governor of New York, or Carly Fiorina, the only woman, the only female Republican in the bunch, they may not make it. And so there's a lot of controversy over, is that the way to introduce the Republican candidates to the American public in their first opportunity?
Well, and here in New Hampshire, and of course I'm sounding completely like a New Hampshire primary booster, but, you know, people here are paying attention. They are going to the events. They are listening to what these candidates are saying. They are paying attention to a Lindsey Graham or George Pataki. So shouldn't they take like a New Hampshire poll, right? I mean, put that in the mix.
Well, yes.
People who are really paying attention.
Well, I agree with that, too. But even if you're still paying attention, I mean, how is Lindsey Graham or George Pataki or Carly Fiorina doing in New Hampshire? I still suspect that they're not doing that strongly. And so whether it's they're doing well in New Hampshire or nationally, I think the point is that there must be some way of doing it in a certain tier system that you can get everybody to make an impression. Otherwise, you know, debates are so important, as President Rick Perry will tell you, that, you know, we learn a lot from presidential debates. And I think robbing the opportunity for any candidate, whether it's a Democrat, you know, anybody of the Democrats as well, is just a big mistake.
Well, so, okay, the top 10 finishers among these from these five national polls will get to be up there on the stage. I have read, though, Ken, from the party's perspective, if an African-American like Ben Carson or a woman like Carly Fiorina doesn't make it to that top tier, you know, party officials are a little concerned that they've got 10 white guys up there again.
That's exactly right. I'm not saying that there's a quota system in presidential candidates. I mean, you know, it's up to the voters, obviously, who becomes the nominee. But it's not going to look good when the Democratic Party has history in the making, the opportunity for Hillary Clinton to be the first female president ever, and to see a Republican debate stage of 10 white guys. It just, as you say, does not look that good.
All right. Well, another candidate jumped in on Saturday. So Lindsey Graham on Monday, Martin O'Malley on Saturday. And just quickly remind us who Martin O'Malley is, Ken.
Former two-term mayor of Baltimore, who then went on to two terms as governor of Maryland. He left Maryland with not great approval numbers, but he did a lot of liberal reform things, you know, a gay marriage, abolishing the death penalty. He is running, hoping to run to Hillary Clinton's left. But, of course, he also had a reputation as mayor of Baltimore of zero. It's called zero tolerance, in that many people, mostly African Americans, were arrested, sometimes without cause, but there are a lot of arrests in Baltimore on this zero tolerance program. And when we saw the outgrowth of the riots in Baltimore following the death, the killing of a black person by the white policeman recently, a lot of people point back to that zero tolerance policies that increased black resentment towards the police that exists to this day. So Martin O'Malley has a mixed record, but again, he's certainly younger than Hillary Clinton. He's trying to make it a generational difference, as Marco Rubio and others are trying to make it with Jeb Bush. And but right now, if you look at the polls, I have not seen a poll with Hillary Clinton with anything less than 65-68%. Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, and Lincoln Chafee, if he gets in, Jim Webb of Virginia, if he gets in, they have a long, tough battle to overtake her.
All right, as we head into a break, Ken, let's hear a little bit of Martin O'Malley, his announcement speech.
And there is something to be learned from that night. There is something to be offered to our country from those flames. For what took place here was not only about race, not only about policing in America, it was about everything it is supposed to mean to be an American.
Again, former Maryland Governor, Baltimore Mayor Martin O'Malley announcing his presidential candidacy. More after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's Political Junkie time on The Exchange, where once a month we talk national politics with political junkie Ken Rudin. And Ken, let's go back to our listeners, get their thoughts on some of the headlines that we've been covering this hour. Jeff's joining us from Springfield, Vermont. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. I bet you could have answered that trivia question, Jeff.
Well, I didn't think of it, but I didn't have my thinking cap on.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I just wanted to ask Ken, I've yet to hear a good explanation for how these conservative hawks, you know, they constantly preach getting government off our backs and getting government out of our business, and yet at the same time, you know, these guys like McConnell and Lindsey Graham, you know, they're all about government intrusion into these phone records and broadly sweeping security powers. So I just, is there how do they reconcile that? I haven't heard a good explanation for that yet.
Jeff, thank you very much. Go ahead, Ken.
It's a good question. I kind of think that 9/11 changed a lot of people's minds. Not that Republicans were so anti-government prior to 9/11, because there was not really much of a libertarian factor in GOP platforms and candidates. But I think after 9/11, as I alluded to earlier, that the famous debate of security versus liberty changed a lot of minds. That a lot of people felt that, well, you know something, I would give up some rights. I would gladly give up some rights to make sure another attack on the World Trade Center or the Pentagon or anything else would never happen again. It just changed the psyche of many Americans, and a lot of Republican candidates took advantage of it in the 2002 and 2004 elections, and it continues today. But you're absolutely right. The Republican Party, ostensibly the party of less government intrusion into your private affairs, in your bedroom, and things like that. That seems like it's a contradiction.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Jeff. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Once a month, we sit down with political junkie Ken Rudin to get his take on some of the big stories that have made political headlines around the country. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Ken, here's an email that came in earlier from Ray in Whitefield asking about something I did want to talk to you about. This is the whole debate over fast-track trade. This has caused some consternation for Democrats, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But Ray says supporters of the TPP, which I think is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Asia trade deal, also state that the trade pact will open the market to millions and millions of new customers for American products. Ray says, what is the rationale? Most of these countries are the poorest in the world and will work for less than subsistence wages. Where are they going to get the money to buy American products? So there's Ray, not a fan of the Trans-Pacific Partnership or Fast Track Trade Authority. Just fill us in on the politics of this, Ken.
Well, it is. It's interesting that it's being pushed by a Democratic president, as NAFTA was in 1993 by another Democratic president, Bill Clinton. But Democrats, most of them Democrats, are fearful of, one, that jobs will be, because of low wages around the world, that the American jobs will be shipped overseas, that it's going to countries that do not have environmental protection or any kind of job protection. It's anathema of what labor unions in this country strongly believe in. So it's interesting that, you had people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and other pro-labor Democrats saying this is just not what the Democratic Party should be standing for. And you have Barack Obama, backed by congressional Republicans, saying it will lead to more jobs and better opportunities for American products.
Well, and speaking of Elizabeth Warren, she has spoken out against this trade deal, connecting it to her chief issue, which is, big banks, financial reform, and so forth. Here's Liz Warren on the Senate floor recently, Senator Warren from Massachusetts, arguing against this fast-track trade authority that her own president, President Obama, wants.
And that's why I'm proposing this amendment, to make sure that no future president can fast-track a trade agreement that weakens our financial regulations. All of my colleagues who believe in holding the big banks accountable and keeping our financial system safe should support this amendment.
Again, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren arguing on the Senate floor against fast-track authority for trade negotiations. I wanted to play that, Ken, partly because we've been talking about trade and Ray's email, but partly because the draft Elizabeth Warren movement has disbanded.
Well, they finally, I guess, took her at her word from the beginning. She said, I'm not running. Not I'm not planning to run, but I'm not running at all. And after all this time, she has not wavered or backed down. There were some people who said, well, maybe if Hillary Clinton showed some weakness over Benghazi or the email fracas or the interesting never-ending stories about the contributions going to the foreign monies going to the Clinton Foundation, that maybe it would show Clinton weakness and it would give Elizabeth Warren an opportunity. She still has not changed her mind, and now the run Warren committees have disbanded. You know, it was interesting the other day, not too long ago, during the Senate debate over the trade bill, how dismissive President Obama was of Elizabeth Warren in a debate, in an interview with, I think it was Yahoo News. And he said basically that, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She has her facts wrong. She has an agenda she needs to follow. And it really exposed, we talk about how security and intelligence and government intrusion has exposed fault lines in the Republican Party. Well, trade policy has certainly done that on the Democratic side. And if you ask Hillary Clinton how she feels about it, she has not given anybody a direct answer. She said, well, I believe in environmental protection and worker protection, but would she support it? She's not said. So, you could fall. A lot of us fault Hillary Clinton for refusing to be specific about so many issues. The alternative, of course, is you could answer every journalist question like Jeb Bush's and get your head handed to you. So maybe Hillary Clinton's philosophy of not talking to the media is working out just fine right now.
Well, it is tricky for Democrats. Just like you said, national security providing some or showing some fissures in the Republican Party. Trade is tough for Democrats.
It always has been.
Yeah, for a long time. Here in New Hampshire, Senators Ayotte and Shaheen did vote for this. In the House, Congresswoman Custer's people say she hasn't decided yet. So it's a tough one. It's a tough
one. And obviously, now that it's passed the Senate, it goes into the House, where there is even stronger opposition among Democratic members. And there are, you know, there are some Republicans, of course, you know, pro-business Republicans, pro-Chamber of Commerce Republicans who support the president on this. But there's a growing number of Tea Party folks who said, look, if Obama's for it, I'm against it. So you may see a very weird bunch of strange alliances between, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party and the right wing of the Republican Party.
You know, I just mentioned New Hampshire's congressional delegation, Ken. And I did want to get your national perspective on the political troubles of a member of Congress from New Hampshire. Frank Ginta, Republican from the 1st District, was cited by the Federal Election Commission for campaign finance violations. Now, this was a while ago. Ginta's been trying to pay the fine, move on. But some top Republicans want him to step aside, most notably Kelly Ayotte. Now, just yesterday, documents were released showing that there's real debate among Ginta family members about what this family pot of money really was that Mr. Ginta has referred to. Now, Ken, we're going to, you know, get into this on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. But just politically, how do congressional Republican leaders there on Capitol Hill view these kind of things?
Well, two ways. One, they want to hold on to every seat they can. I mean, of course, they have a nice, sizable majority in the House. It's right now it's 246 to 188, which is not bad. So they want, and especially in a seat that's marginal, like that New Hampshire seat, which has gone back and forth, as we've seen over the years. So they want to hold on to it. But at the same time, if an incumbent is seen as vulnerable or risky, you want to get the strongest candidate in there. They're not convinced that Ginta has to step down, although Kelly Ayotte, as you pointed out, has called for him to step down. Now, you know, it's one thing if Maggie Hassan says, you know, he's no longer have any effect. I mean, it doesn't matter what your Democratic senator says, and it may not even matter to him what Kelly Ayotte says. But when your own mother and sister say that, well, you're not really exactly telling the truth, that this is really not your money, this was our money, and this was just a loan and not, you know, money for you to dig into, that could be problematic.
What does it mean for Senator Ayotte's political influence, political career, run for re-election in 2016, that she's come out so early and strongly on this? And yet here's Frank Ginta, you know, hanging on.
Yeah, I suspect that has a lot to do with it. Obviously, there's talk of if Governor Hassan runs for the Senate, Kelly Ayotte will have a very tough battle. I think she's been an effective senator. She's certainly very well, highly regarded in the Republican leadership. She's done a lot of things that for the leadership that have gotten her high marks with them. But I mean, you know, with a tough battle, she doesn't want any distractions, and she fears that Congressman Ginta's financial worries could prove to be a distraction.
Again, our number here in the exchange. We're sitting down with Ken Rudin, political junkie, looking at some of the top political headlines of the nation. Once a month, we talk to Ken about all the top political stories, and we'd love your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Ken, here's an email from Robert in Epsom. He says, has it become a mainstream priority that any candidates are talking about the epidemic of drug abuse and the resultant infections requiring long hospital stays that are exhausting healthcare resources? Boy, in rural America, you know, I know you know this, Ken, the heroin epidemic, people worried about fentanyl, lots of people dying in New Hampshire of heroin
crystal
and other
meth,
drug.
Meth,
yeah,
right.
I mean, in Indiana, there's that county that made, you know, national
right.
headlines where AIDS has returned because of drug use. Are presidential candidates talking about this, or are they so busy debating the NSA that they're not really paying attention?
Well, you know, I mean, not to dismiss this issue at all, because everywhere you go in middle America, the issue of heroin abuse and heroin deaths and crystal meth and things like that, that it's on the rise. And so in some communities, alarmingly so. But has it reached the point of political discussion? I have not heard it. I have not heard a single candidate talk about it. I did hear Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, who was prospective presidential candidate at one point, talk about it a lot, but he's not running. But I have not heard a single candidate address this issue.
Okay. Well, here in New Hampshire, I think they will be asked if they haven't been asked already. So, Robert, thank you for that email. You know, talking about politicians getting into hot water like Frank Ginta, I did want to ask you, Ken, real briefly about Dennis Hastert. Now, a lot of listeners might not even remember who he was. Just remind us.
He was the longest-serving speaker, Republican speaker, in the history of Congress. He took over after Newt Gingrich was forced out after 1998, and he served 8 years, which doesn't sound like a long time, but no Republican has served that much longer. And the reason he was picked as speaker in 1998 was that he had no skeletons, he was clean, he was reliable, he was solid. I mean, everybody liked him. I don't know a single journalist who ever covered him who didn't like him. I mean, of course, likability and honesty does not always go hand in hand, obviously. But when we saw the indictment that delivered last Thursday, that basically he took out illegally unreported large sums of money from banks and lied to the FBI about it.
Wow.
And then further indications that he may have taken this money to pay somebody, perhaps a student when he was a wrestling coach, an inappropriate relationship with decades ago, to a person. And I've spoken to a few members of Congress on this as well. They are just stunned. They're still in shock that Denny Hastert could be accused of anything like this. Now, Hastert has not said a word. I think he appears in court tomorrow and maybe we'll learn something, but he has not said a denial. He's not had an attorney say anything. It's just stunning. And I guess the big irony, of course, is the fact that he was picked as a consensus choice for speaker because he was just so non-controversial. And here he is allegedly, I mean, I'm saying allegedly because that's important,
right,
but allegedly having this secret about inappropriate behavior with a minor for decades.
Well, and I have to ask you about one very just heartbreaking headline from Washington politics. Beau Biden, Ken, 46-year-old son of Vice President Joe Biden, died recently. Just unfathomable loss for the vice president.
It's unfathomable for no other reason than to think of all the grief and the tragedy that the Biden family has gone through. When Joe Biden was elected to the Senate, first elected in 1972, a month later, his wife, his 30-year-old wife, his 18-month-old daughter, and of course the two boys, Beau and his other brother Andrew, they were in a car coming back home from buying a Christmas tree. A tractor trailer ran into them. His wife was killed. His 18-month-old daughter was killed. His two sons were badly hurt. And I mean, for the longest time, Joe Biden thought about just not even taking the Senate seat. How could you go on through that? And I've seen over the years Joe Biden talk about that loss and that sense, that grief. And he had a very interesting speech a few years ago before the families of fallen veterans. And he talked about, like, sometimes you don't know if you can go on. Sometimes you actually think of suicide because how can you cope? And to have that heartache and to have that sadness in your life and then to lose basically your best friend. He was so close to Beau Biden. Beau Biden was the former two-term state attorney general of Delaware. He had already announced he was running for governor in 2016.
Ah, I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Gee,
and was considered the favorite. He was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2013, but got a clean bill of health in November of 2013. And then earlier this year, apparently there was a relapse. And then when it was announced in May that Beau Biden was going to Walter Reed Hospital, everybody realized that, oh my God, this is serious. And you just can't imagine what Joe Biden and his family are going through, have gone through. And it's just so terribly, terribly sad.
Yeah, it hurts.
It does.
To think about it. Well, last question for you, Ken. Big political stories you'll be watching in the next few weeks. We'll be talking to you a month from now. For example, presidential announcements waiting in the wings.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we have 10 with Rick Perry announcing tomorrow. We have 10 Republicans, but we still don't have Jeb Bush and Scott Walker and Chris Christie and Bobby Jindal and John Kasich and Donald Trump. Can't forget him. So, I mean, we're going to have these announcements. But more importantly, I want to see what they're going to do this summer as we head into that first August 6th debate, because it's, you know, as a lot of people say that, you know, you could run for president and then try to build up support, but now there's more pressure on them to do it earlier than ever because of the debate.
So they've got June and July to kind of really work it, and then we'll see what happens in August. Ken, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Laura, thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye. That's political junkie Ken Rudin. He'll be back next month with our monthly check-in with the political junkie. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer this week is David Darman. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.